This audio comes to you from the Science of Mind archives.
This is tape number 4 of Dr. Barker's private recordings on the Bible, and the topic for tonight is the new consciousness symbolized by Jesus. The appearance of Jesus is one of the most interesting things we have in the recorded history of man. The appearance of most other great teachers and saviors were inspired mainly by a small group of people who had something to say. This was not true of Jesus. There was not a group as such that needed him, because the whole wide Western world needed him. Let me give you an illustration of this. The entire world was under one government for one of the few times in its history. The entire world was under the rule of the Roman government. And while the entire world was made up of many nations and many peoples, many tribes, many religions, nevertheless there was a unified world for almost the first and almost the last time in all of history. Second, there was one world religion for the first time. The common religion and the business religion and the literature religion at the time of Jesus' birth was Greek. Whether you were in India, whether you were in North Africa, whether you were in Spain, whether you were in Gaul, whether you were in what today we call Britain, you spoke Greek. You may have used the local language in dealing with local people, but you read and understood Greek. Just as in almost all sections of Europe today, French is a language understood. So in the days of the time of Jesus, there was one universal language, Greek, one nation, one nationality, Rome. This meant great interchange of ideas. This meant great ease of travel. If any of you have ever made a quick trip of Europe, you know you spend half your life at a customs office getting rid of old money, getting new money to go into the next country, having your passport fixed, having yourself looked over. In the days of Jesus, you could travel from India to Britain and never be stopped once. Never have a language difficulty. Never have a monetary difficulty. There was one coin, one monetary system used throughout the entire Roman Empire. So there were no borders to be passed. There were no language difficulties. And all of this makes for great ease and communication of ideas. This is why Christianity, once it started, spread so fast. Christianity has been called the fastest single growing religion there's ever been in the history of the world. The others have struggled for centuries to arrive at great distribution of ideas. But Christianity spread out like a fan just as quickly almost as it happened. Within 50 years after the death of Jesus, Jesus was known about in the entire known world. He may not have been accepted as a teacher, but he was known. The stories about him were known because of this great flexibility of both language, money, and one great unified country. Third, all the religious ideas of the day were confused. Everybody was all mixed up. The great North African continent which in those days, you know, was a very populous place. It was not yet as fully encroached upon by desert as it is now. And in this great populous section of the world, the southern side of the Mediterranean, there were innumerable, all mixed up kinds of religions. The Egyptians were still trying to hang on to some of their ancient ideas. All through there were all kinds of things. Over in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, there were the remains of all kinds of religions. Greece was thoroughly dissatisfied because it had had its Greek religion, and now it had its Roman religion. And the Greeks, you know, never really were taken in by their own religion. The gods and the goddesses on Mount Olympus were considered quite fun, even in their most serious days, you know. You see, the gods and goddesses on Mount Olympus symbolized all the things that everybody wanted to do. And as you know, there wasn't much morality. You getting what I'm talking about? The gods and goddesses on Mount Olympus did everything that everybody who was frustrated wished they could do. Does that make it better? No, you don't get it yet. So even the Greeks, in their heyday, didn't take their own gods and goddesses too seriously as great creative powers. And later, when the Roman system came through, and they realized that the chief god of all of Rome was the emperor, and may I say, in Jesus' day and long before and long after, the standard of personal life on the part of the emperors was not that of one that should be examined too closely. And therefore, people were uneasy. They had to accept the emperor as God, but it was a faith-saving measure. They knew he wasn't. They knew that the great imperial throne couldn't have been. There was too much looseness in the whole structure of the Roman Empire as far as morals were concerned. Everywhere in the world, there was immorality, and it was accepted. There was dishonesty, and it was accepted, except in one place. If you were to take a map of the entire Roman Empire at its peak, and seek the one place where the next great Messiah could be born, you would immediately, if you knew your history, turn to this little country on the far end of the Mediterranean Sea. This country that it come down through, known under many names, but we'll use the New Testament name of Palestine. And in this little country, only some 150 miles long and 65 miles wide at the time of Jesus, here were the remnants of the only moral people on the face of the globe. The only people that really had a code that said, thou shalt not commit adultery. The only people that had a code which said thou should be honest. The only people who said that God was one. And so, Jesus was born in Palestine of the Jews. Absolute necessity from the viewpoint of history. Because there was no other place which would be logical for the birth of the next great world teacher. And so that is where he is placed, that is where he lives. Now this raises a question always, because many students have heard teachers of metaphysics say, well, there probably wasn't a Jesus, that he is a symbol and there never was such a man. I'd like to tell you this. I believe there was a Jesus. I don't know that we have him at exactly the right date. I do not know that all the stories attributed to him are absolutely true. No one knows this. Because when you write about a person 50 years after his death, why, you can write almost anything you want. And particularly because you never write down the failures of a famous man. You know, you only write down his triumph. But I'm sure there was a Jesus, and I'll tell you why I am. There was a Peter and there was a Paul. There is historical absolute proof of the existence of Peter, and there is absolute historical proof of the existence of Paul. There is great historical proof of the early days of the Christian church and of the early Christian church teachers. There is great proof of this, all scattered around. You see, as I said in an earlier lecture, history isn't history unless it's written or is pictured. And one of the most phenomenal things to the Bible scholar is that with all that the four Gospels make of Jesus, and with all that the letters of Paul and Peter and the others make of Jesus, with the great spread of the early Christian church, which was a phenomenal growth, just mushroomed right up, there is absolutely not one shred of historical proof of the existence of Jesus. There isn't a single document that has ever been found telling about a rabbi named Jesus. And remember, he was a rabbi. He called himself rabbi. Others called him rabbi. You can find this if you read your four Gospels again. There is no record anywhere. There are plenty of records of other things. Oh, my heavens, these people wrote and wrote and wrote. Records were kept all during the Greek and Roman Empire of the most trivial things. You can go up here to the Metropolitan Museum or other places and you can find records of what women bought at stores in those days, how women dressed, how men dressed, what they did with their spare time, the recipes for their favorite wines and liquors. Their food. We know all about these things from written records that have been discovered, uncovered in the field of archaeology. But there isn't a single thing that tells about Jesus. Now, this is amazing because, according to the four Gospels, this man should have been written about all over the world. I mean, you don't go around raising the dead and healing incurable illnesses and walking on water and feeding 5,000 people, and it doesn't get nosed around, even a day without newspapers. You'd think that someone would have remarked about it. But to date, they haven't. You see, let's say that one of you goes up to one of the great theological seminaries, the ones that preach the loudest about Jesus. And you get a hold of one of the professors in the Department of New Testament History. And you pin him down. You ask him this question: is there any actual historical proof of the existence of Jesus? He will clear his throat. He'll take off his glasses and wipe them and put them back on. He'll say, now, oh, well, we know because of Paul, we know because of Peter, we know because of this. Wait a minute, Professor. I asked you a question. Can you or any other of the top Bible scholars show me a shred of factual evidence that there ever was a Jesus? Well, again, he will go all around the circle. And if you pin him down, he'll say, no, but. And he'll go around the circle. Now, does this mean there wasn't a Jesus? As some teachers say, of course not. I'll tell you why there was a Jesus or his equivalent. Because the infinite mind, the divine spirit, whatever this creative power is, can only work by means of man. It can only reveal itself by means of man. God as God has never painted a masterpiece. God as God has never danced a great dance. God as God has never produced a great symphony. But God uses a great painter, a great dancer, a Tchaikovsky. God uses a Moses, an Isaiah, a Peter, and a Paul. And so there was someone, and we might just as well take and use the name of Jesus. We have no reason not to. Because without a Jesus, you could not have had Christianity, because great spiritual movements do not come out of people's composite ideas. They come out of a person. There would be no Christian Science without Mrs. Eddy. There would be no Unity Movement without the Fillmores. There would be no Religious Science Movement without Ernest Holmes. There'd be no First Church in New York without Raymond Barker. And don't kid yourself for 1 minute. Now, You couldn't have had the Jews without Moses. You couldn't. Because Moses, while he is remembered for the Ten Commandments, please remember it was Moses that established the Jewish church through his brother Aaron. It had none up to them. Therefore, you could not have had the Jewish religion without Moses. And you could not have had Christianity without a Jesus. You could not have had a Buddhism without a Buddha. And every time that there's been an attempt to create a religion without a founder, this is the weakness of the Baha'i movement, which had a founder, by the way. And if they'll just stick with their founder and not try to take everybody else in, they'll have a darn good religion. But this is the weakness of such groups as the ethical culture movement, which is one of the finest teachings you could have. But it holds very little interest for the average person because it has no strong person to symbolize what it's talking about. You see? And so the Mormons without Joseph Smith couldn't have been. And all the rest, we go right straight down the line. The Four Square Gospel Church, which is one of the strongest of the Pentecostal churches in the United States today, was founded by a group of people, founded by Amy Semple McPherson. And they still wish she hadn't gone in bathing. That church could never have been founded. Those of you that don't remember the story, go and read it again. It's a glorious story of a great woman. Came to a rather tragic end, but a number of great women, including Camille, have come to a tragic end. No, you couldn't have had the Four Square Gospel Church around the world, this is, without a Mrs. Amy Semple McPherson. So there had to be a Jesus. You can't have a religion without a great leader appearing to announce it. So for me, whether there is an actual historicity to the man, nevertheless, there is this something that happened, appeared, revealed, and came about. And we know just about exactly when it happened. Because we have accurate dates on Peter. We have accurate dates on Paul. We have accurate dates on most of the disciples. And we have very accurate dates on the authors of every book of the New Testament, all of whom were Pharisees, by the way. The very people Jesus didn't seem to like. Remember how he upbraided them outrageously all the time. Yet these were the scholars, you see. These were the wiser, I won't say wiser, these were the better trained people. They wrote the books of the New Testament. No, there was a Jesus. Not because of a Paul or a Peter, but because an idea doesn't happen unless it happens through someone. So, the Kodak happened through Eastman. Rubber tires through Firestone. Automobiles through the early pioneers, only one of which was Henry Ford. These things happen through people. Christianity had to happen through a person, and it happened through Jesus. Now, we'll tell you some interesting things. Here is a man about which we know absolutely nothing, factually, and yet he is the most interesting man that has ever appeared in Western civilization. Here is a man whom no one knows what he ever looked like, and there are more pictures and statues of Jesus than of any other single individual in the history of the universe. Now you're going to say, but Dr. Barker, what about Veronica's veil? Well, make a real study of Veronica's veil, will you? Look it up in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Go to a good theological library and see where it was found and who found it. And, Dr. Barker, what about the cradle in Bethlehem that Jesus was rocked in? Oh, dear. Go look at it. Made around 1500. Put in there, probably by the Crusaders. Nice little cradle. Nothing wrong with a cradle. Except they didn't use cradles in Jesus' day. That's the only thing that's wrong with it, you see. What we've done with this man is absolutely fantastic. We cannot write this man off as a myth, but we can see that it needs a larger picture, it needs a larger horizon of presentation, because no one knows what he looked like. Now, you're going to say, well, Dr. Barker, I once read a description of him written by a very early Christian teacher who lived in Greece. Yes, I've read it, so has everyone else. It is in the British Museum in London, and if you will go there and look in fine print under it, it says, believed by all scholars to be a complete piece of forgery. You'll tell me, well, but there's a book written by the Rosicrucians, and they know everything that Jesus did. Well, if they do, they're the only people on earth that do. And the scholars that have tried to check on the sources of information, see, they say that there's a cave in India where Jesus Christ wrote his name. Well, the Bible scholars have pled with the people who publish these books to let them know where this cave is. And they've looked in almost every cave they can find. And this has never been found. The story of his going to Egypt, to Greece, making the grand tour all during those lost years of his life, there is not one word of factual proof. Now, he may have done it. And I perhaps believe he did do it. Because there's too much in his teaching that is universal. There is too much in his teaching that includes the good of others, spiritual systems. It may well be that he made that trip and spent those years. But to come out and say as an absolute statement that Jesus went through four grades of initiation in Egypt is an unprovable statement. Now, it's a fascinating one. There is a book available in the New Thought field that I think is one of the most charming in the world. I will not let it be sold in this church. But you look for it, you can find it around. Some metaphysical church in this vicinity will have it for you. It's called The Aquarian Gospel by Levi. One of the most charming, delightful stories of the life and teaching of Jesus that you will ever read. I wish it were true. It's so beautiful. There is a chapter in there on the silence that is unforgettable. It tells all about Jesus, his birth, tells about his travels until he was the age of 30. It gives sermons that we have no record of in the four Gospels. It is perfectly charming. But it isn't his. It isn't history, and it isn't factual. Now, you're going to say, but Dr. Barker, it was psychically received. I respect psychic communications, except when they deal with historical facts, and then I put them in a category of questions. many good psychic mediums have had someone come through and speak through them who said they were Jesus. And I can't say they weren't. I can only say there is always an element of doubt if you're dealing with anything other than pure history. So you may, many of you, I can see by the looks on your faces, have read much of this material or heard much of this material. But ladies and gentlemen, if you're going to be an historical metaphysician, you have to be sure of your facts. And there is no proof of what Jesus did before the, well, I was going to say before the age of 30, there's no proof of the end of his death. End of his life. But to me, the only proof of Jesus is the fact that he is Christianity. You see, the name Jesus itself was a very common name. It was more common than Robert would be today. More common than John or James would be today. You see, it was a common name. That is why they had no last name. They were known only by their villages. Or by their father. You would be known as Jesus, the son of Joseph, or you would be known as Jesus of Nazareth. He was known in our writings as Jesus of Nazareth. Meaning one of the Jesus people who came from Nazareth. Meaning there might have been in the village of Nazareth six men named Jesus. Certainly in Jerusalem you'd have found 5,000-6,000 people with the name of Jesus. All you have to do now is to go to South America. Or even into Mexico, and you'll find untold thousands of people with the name of Jesus. And many of them are called Jesus Christ. You'll find the name in the front of a little grocery store, that Jesus Christ, with the last name, owns this store. It is a common name, as common as is the word Mary, which again has been built up and symbolized as Mary, the mother of Jesus. And yet, probably in this room, between first and second names, ask for your hands, and there'd be a dozen Marys in this room. So it was with Jesus. So again, you're dealing with something that you can't pinpoint down. We have no birth record of him. We have no death record of him. But I'm sure he was. Enough of that. The most colorful figure in history, we don't know what he looked like. The most intriguing character in history, and we know the very least about him. Sometimes take your Bible and open it, and take just the four Gospels and hold them together. Here's this massive Old Testament material. Here's a larger mass of the writings of Paul and the others. But in the middle is just this little bit covering the four Gospels. And yet, those four Gospels have changed the history of the world. They have created, caused, and maintained so-called Western civilization. They are today the most read, the most revered of all the scriptures, probably of all time, at least in the Western tradition. And here they are. And they are read, they are accepted without question, which is good for many people. They have been the great source of comfort, a source of healing, a source of peace, certainly a source of inspiration. And out of the life of this man has come more novels, more books, more plays, more of everything than has ever come from a single individual in all time. And yet we know so little about him. Even when we read the four Gospels, we know so little about him. We know almost nothing about he nor or his family. And yet we have built up this great tradition to fill in the gap. So that the average church and the average clergyman can talk about Jesus for hours on end. And tell all about his mother. And tell all about this and all about that, and make the whole thing alive, because he's able to fill in with the background of the time, not because he's dealing with facts. Because in order to teach Jesus, you have to novelize Jesus, because the factual Jesus is difficult to find. So this raises the question, but after all, Dr. Barker, aren't the four Gospels factual? They are as factual as anything can be, unless we find something more factual that we haven't stated. Please remember that the first Gospel written was Mark, and it wasn't written until 50 years after the death of Jesus. Well, actually, I'll take that back. It was written 70 A.D. So it was written 37 years. The first one to write a biography of Jesus wrote it 37 years after his death. Now, that's a long time. And you can forget a great deal and you can add a great deal in 37 years. Now, am I trying to infer that the history in Mark isn't accurate? No. I'm just raising a question in your mind. I think the history in Mark would be fairly accurate because Mark was Jesus' own first cousin. Mark was Jesus' own first cousin. And if you know how closely knit the Jewish family life is in Orthodox Jewry, if you can realize, particularly taking it back 2,000 years, how closely knit this family life would have been, rest assured that if you were peculiar in any way, your first cousins knew it. In fact, you and I that don't have closely knit families, we know quite a little about some of our first cousins, don't we? And they're not spiritual geniuses either. No. No. Now, if any of them gets the least bit off the pathway, oh boy. You see, because Mary calls Anna, and Anna calls Francis, and Francis calls somebody else, and she calls somebody else, and with the Bell telephone system as it is today, well, in the days of Jesus, you didn't need a Bell telephone system because everybody lived within a half mile of everybody else. Families didn't scatter in Jesus' day. All your relatives lived right around you, and all you had to do was meet at the common well in the middle of the village. You went there every day to get water anyway, and all of your in-laws went, and all your cousins went, and that's why the well was the newspaper of its day, you see. It was the telephone system of its day. Everybody went to the village well for water. And it wasn't pumped in, please remember. It wasn't piped in. It didn't go with your lease. You walked a half a mile to get it. That's why it was so precious to you. So Mark, I'm sure, would have known about Jesus. And the most interesting thing about the Gospel of Mark is it never mentions Jesus first. Now, if you had a first cousin, and he had been born under very strange circumstances, wouldn't you know it? Sure you'd know it. Mark never mentions the birth of Jesus. He starts his life of Jesus at the age of 30, beginning of his ministry. Very interesting. Another thing. The man who wrote the Gospel of John, the most beautiful of the Gospels, what is considered the great spiritual understanding Gospel. That is the John the writer, called by scholars John the Elder because he called himself John the Elder. This is not John the Apostle. This is not John the Apostle. John the Apostle could not have been at the cross. You remember when they took Jesus, all the disciples fled. It says so. If John the Apostle had been at the foot of the cross to take care of Jesus' mother, they'd have all been arrested and murdered. John the Apostle could not have been at the foot of the cross because the disciples were soft. So it was not John the Apostle, the disciple, at the foot of the cross. It was another John. Again, you're dealing with a common name. There are four Johns and five Marys in the New Testament. So if you get mixed up, don't worry. Even Bible scholars have trouble keeping them apart. Now, the John who wrote the Epistle of John, the three short epistles of John, wrote the book of Revelation and wrote the Gospel of John. Wrote them very late, by the way, as late as 120 years after Jesus' birth. That would be 90 years after his death. This John had Mary in his home. This John took Mary, the mother of Jesus, and took her to his home at Ephesus, up the road a long way, the same old road I talked about earlier, and she lived with him until she died. And this John, who wrote the last gospel, who would have known Matthew's gospel, he certainly would have known Mark's, had been written and in circulation for a long time. He certainly would have known Luke, written 15, 20 years before his, and he must have read it. This is a great man, a great scholar, and a great spiritual genius. But what does he open his gospel with? The birth of Jesus? No. He opens with, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And it goes right straight into John the Baptist. It goes right into the baptism and into the ministry of Jesus. Not one word about Mary. Not one word about Bethlehem in Judea. Not one word at all. Not one word. Now here are two people that if ever anyone would have known, they would have known. And bless the people that wrote Matthew and Luke, the two other gospels, because they made an awful mistake. They just made the worst mistake. It's even, I hate to mention this, it's even in the Douay Bible, meaning the Catholic Bible. And the mistake they made is in Matthew, it's in the very first chapter, and I'm sure that the Roman Church shudders every time it's read. It gives the genealogy of Jesus. And please remember that the Hebrews only had a male genealogy because of the total unimportance of women. They didn't keep any records on women. They only kept records on men. And bless the writer of Matthew, or as I think, this was material added about 400 years later, and many scholars believe this, they traced the genealogy of Jesus from Abraham, the first Jew, down to whom? Down to Joseph. Not to Mary. Is this you perk in your gray matter? Now in the third chapter of Luke, the man who wrote the introduction for this gospel, because I'm sure Luke only wrote the main section of the gospel, he was writing for the Greeks, of course, and the Romans. He was not writing for the Jews. See, Matthew was writing for the Jews, so he made Jesus a descendant of Abraham. And made Joseph Jesus' father. And then three lines later says that he was born of a virgin who was conceived by the Holy Ghost. Now in Luke, whoever wrote the beginning chapters, because in the third chapter, in this book now written for the Greeks and the Romans and the rest of the world as well as the Jews, he wasn't going to be outdone by Matthew. So he said, listen, let's not start with Abraham. That's ridiculous. So whiz, he goes right straight back to Adam. Yes, sir, right back to the first man. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there were accurate genealogies maintained in Jesus' day. Everyone knew their family background for way, way back. But I can rest you can rest assured they didn't know him as far back as Adam. Because, as I've told you before, there was no such nice guy as Adam. He's a symbol in a beautiful folklore story. So they take him with. But again, even Luke, in his genealogy, shows Joseph to be his father. Shows Joseph to be the father of Jesus. And three lines later says that Mary was visited by the Holy Ghost and conceived and brought forth her firstborn and named him Emmanuel, who was later called Jesus. See your name change again? You're Abraham becoming Abraham, you're Jacob becoming Israel. Here we have what? We have Emmanuel becoming a Jesus. I wish that it is less than Emmanuel, because it means God with us. And I think that's kind of much nicer, poetically speaking, than Jesus, because Jesus means he shall save you from your sins. And I don't know, I still got some of mine. If there's anyone present without any, you may leave now, and we'll refund the $1. I see no one going to the door. Now, I wish they'd left it at Emmanuel, a very beautiful name, Emmanuel. So this is all very interesting. You're going to say, what's this got to do with metaphysical study? It has this to do. We're not out, or at least I am not out, in any way to detract from the greatness of Jesus. But I am out to put Jesus in what I feel is a better balance picture. I do not believe Jesus to be a curious phenomena of a peculiar God that acts in abnormal ways to produce an abnormal man to go around saying abnormal things in order to produce an abnormal religion. I believe in a divine intelligence which works intelligently, which works through the intelligent ways it already has produced, the intelligent processes which it already has set up. I believe in the divine normalcy of Jesus. I don't think it makes a hoot in heck how he was born. Because I think the genius of Jesus stands on its own feet, regardless of whether he had a father or whether he didn't. I think the Sermon on the Mount is what it is, not because of a peculiar birth, but because of what it is. I think the great stories about this man are just as great, whether he was born of a virgin, which of course now we know absolutely he was not, or whether he was born in a normal childbirth. So, I like to say this. I'm not detracting one bit. I think this adds to the greatness of Jesus. I think for a man, back in those days, because remember, this country was saturated with Roman soldiers, Roman officers, Roman people, Roman citizens. The government was pretty much Roman. There was everything there that any young man who wanted to could have become a commercial success. He could have become an immoral individual very easily, as can a young person today. He could have become anything he wanted to be. But here was an individual who was born into a spiritual system, and apparently from the very first, the only reason we know this is what he said later, apparently from the very beginning, saturated himself with both great spiritual ideas and great spiritual convictions of the necessity of morality and honesty. And therefore he arises out of a dissolute civilization and begins to make great announcements of spiritual truths and spiritual moral and ethic codes. I think this is kind of wonderful. And I think that this is the greatness of the man, not merely because he was born. I'm sure that he was only given the birth story because of his being born in an Oriental country, because it seemed necessary to do it. Because, what did they say? What good thing comes out of Nazareth? Remember that place in the New Testament? It's like in the old days of vaudeville. New York people used to say, well, what good thing comes out of Hoboken? Remember how everybody always used poor Hoboken as a source and butt of jokes? Well, now the same thing in Los Angeles, they use Long Beach as their source. Used to use Pasadena. What was the movie star? Bob Hope. Didn't he poke fun at poor Pasadena until somebody finally suggested he pick another town? The same thing. What good thing could come out of Nazareth? But always remember that the great spiritual geniuses have never come out of the academic circle. Please remember that they have come out of the simple, the uncluttered, the people who have air to breathe, the people who have time to think, the people who are not rushing to get home and to stop at the laundry and then go to the delicatessen. And then, with their arms laden, get to their apartment house, to get on the elevator, to drop everything at the door of their apartment in order to dig into a great big deep bag. A big bag. And poke and poke and poke and poke, and finally up comes a bunch of keys. They didn't even carry keys. Say there wasn't anything to steal. Unless you're rich. And out comes the key, and you open the door, you fumble in the dark for the light, then you stoop over to get all the packages, and by this time, the bag from the delicatessen always breaks. Am I right? Yes. You get everything inside the door, you shut it with a sigh of relief and take your shoes off. I know. Now, this isn't the climate through which great spiritual ideas are born. Great spiritually minded people usually come out of the uncluttered. They come from where there is air to breathe and space to see, through which to see things. They come where there is the least amount of tension. You see, this is where the great minds come from. Moses, 40 years, it says, symbolically, in the wilderness before he got his spiritual idea. 40 years in quietness, tending sheep. And then he got it. See, Jesus, 40 days in the wilderness, again, another symbol. Then he got it. There it is. There was his idea. Outside of Jerusalem, not inside Jerusalem. Everybody inside of Jerusalem in Jesus' day was just like everybody inside of New York. Everybody was yakety-yakking. Everybody was trying to make money. And everybody was trying to make a profit at the same time everybody was trying to get it at a discount. They were doing that in Jesus' day. They've been doing it since the year one. That was Jerusalem. Jesus didn't, you know, get his great illumination in Jerusalem. No. Outside of Jerusalem, over by the Dead Sea, over where there weren't people, over there where there were great vistas to look at, there was great air to breathe, there a spiritual idea could come through. And so, who would pay much attention to a little, practically a farm boy from a little village of Nazareth? Nobody knew anything about Nazareth. Nazareth was in the Old Testament about like Levittown is on Long Island, or some new suburb in California. Nazareth is never even mentioned in the Old Testament. was never heard of. Nazareth at the time of Jesus was only 100 years old, as a little tiny village. By the way, if you ever go there, they'll show you the house that he lived in, but don't pay it any attention to them. But it's nice to look and say yes, to save the guy. But there's no proof of anywhere. But to come back, they had to build up a story to make a great world teacher, you see. Look what we did with Blessed George Washington. Bless his heart, he was born with some money. So he has a nice big home. And everybody goes to Washington, D.C. and goes over to see it. And there it is. It's a nice home. And they've got the Lee Mansion to look at because his family had money. And we've got what is supposedly a log cabin over in Illinois somewhere. It may be a restored one where Lincoln was born. But this is in a period of saving things. And we didn't have that in Jesus' day, unless it was a great emperor, great someone else to save things. So here is this figure of Jesus. Well, colorful thing. Now, what does all this symbolize? It symbolizes that you don't have to have any false stories about you. You're great anyway. I know some people in this room that I think are perfectly wonderful people. I don't know where you were born. I don't know what your mother's name. I don't know what your father's name was. I don't know what your great-grandmother's name was, and I don't know what family tree you came down. Now, there's a couple of characters in the room. I do know their family tree. But there are most of you I don't, you see. And yet I know your greatness, and I know your goodness, and I know what you've done for other people, and I know what you've done for families, and I know what you've done for yourself. And that, to me, is far more important than where you were born. And so it is to this. To me, Jesus symbolizes. Now I'm going to pure metaphysics. Jesus is the symbol of the outer man expressing spirituality. Christ is the symbol of the inner man expressing the pure ideas of God. Mr. Charles Fillmore used to tell us, and has written in his book, that Jesus is God's idea of the outer man, and Christ is God's idea of the inner man. And may I recommend to you the Metaphysical Bible Dictionary published by Unity, and just look up Jesus, or in Jesus Christ, and look it up, and you'll find at least 6 to 8 pages there, which give the entire symbology of his life as related to your own mind. It's absolutely fascinating. See, we may question the historicity, I love that word, the historicity of the virgin birth. But the metaphysical truth is that as symbol it is right, whether it is factual as, which I'm sure it isn't. You know, the New American Revised Bible came out a few years ago and was published with the consent of the major Orthodox churches, including the Lutherans and the Episcopalians, because it was published with the consent of their top scholars in their top theological seminary. Well, Nelson and Company published it, got an advance sale of some million copies, and the day came when it was off the presses and the million copies began to be destroyed. And naturally, usually the first copies went to the Lutheran clergy and the Episcopalian clergy and the Baptist clergy and the Methodist clergy and around. Well, that thing hadn't been out 6 hours when the Lutherans blew a gasket. The Episcopalians had a stroke. The Baptists jumped right back into the baptismal, you know, thing under the pulpit to get dunked all over again. The Methodists had an awful time. Because in this book, authorized by the Episcopal Church, the Lutheran Church, and all the rest of the churches, it says that Jesus was born of a young woman, instead of saying that Jesus was born of a virgin. Because every scholar, even in the days of King James, every scholar knew that in the Bible times, the word virgin meant a young woman. It did not mean an untouched woman. It had nothing to do with the sex act at all. It merely meant a young woman, which merely meant that Mary was probably only 16 when Jesus was born. You're going to say, isn't that awful? No. Only in later Western civilizations have we delayed marriages and increased frustration. The Orient has always been smarter. They have always married early, when the body needs are at their peak. Not us. My boy is going to go to high school. My boy going to go to college. My boy is going to get a master's degree. And if he wants to go on to a doctor's degree, my boy is going to have a doctor's degree. Then he's going in the army for 2 years, my boy is. And after that, he'll be 28, and then he can get married. And if that girl down the block tries to interfere with my plans for my son, God help her. And what do we say? My daughter. My daughter. Going to go to college. And my daughter is going to get a master's degree. And after my daughter is 23, then if she wants to marry that man, she can marry him. In the Orient, they say, let's get married between 12 and 14 and take the physical pressure off. Then you can go along and create a life. So don't be surprised if the mother of Jesus might have been 14, 16, with the wisdom of the Orient, you see. And so it goes. And that Bible today, oh, I'm telling you, if you can get out the newspapers, you can just go down to the library and read the newspapers of what the bishop stormed and raved and hollered and everybody got excited. It stayed in print, however, and it has sold millions of copies. Why? Because it's exactly what blessed Dr. Moffat put in his translation 20 years before. It's exactly what is in the New English Bible that has just been released in the last few months. Why? Because at last the scholars are beginning to tell the truth. Now, but what's all this got to do with you? Because when you live the spiritual life, new ideas are going to be born in your consciousness without any material reason. So there's your virgin birth. Where do great ideas come from? They come out of the universal mind, and they need no material agent. So you see, in reality, at the image level, at the symbol level, the virgin birth is as true as can be. So maybe it's just as well it is in the Bible. Because every great idea that will ever come into your mind will come because it has come direct from God and not from man. That is where Mr. Eastman got the Kodak. That's where Mr. Carrier got air conditioning. That's where Mr. Hines got beans. Yes. Why do you have beautiful costume jewelry instead of expensive jewelry? Because eventually men and women woke up and ideas popped in their heads and they developed magnificent costume jewelry. So it goes. Every idea is born virginal. Every great new idea comes through the virginal concept of consciousness. So that is the virgin birth. And Jesus is the symbol of the individual who, through choice, disciplines his consciousness, lets great spiritual ideas be born in him, announces them, gives them freely to the world, and leaves a good behind. That is Jesus. And more of this on the next page. All right.
For more spiritual content like this, visit scienceofmindarchives.com.